Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 472, titled Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on August 15th of the year 2004. Before we get into the main body of the broadcast, which will be bringing up to date a number of stories that we've covered in the past, obviously, from the title, be aware that, first of all, sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. The Spitfire CD duplication service stocks the various tapes and lectures, the various programs and lectures I've done over the years. You can reach them by regular mail at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. In the Spitfire website, For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record 472 available within a week or so of the airing of this program. Be aware that the Spitfire website is equipped with Real Audio. The most recently recorded pair of half-hour segments is available for a week or so following the recording of the broadcast. And again, be aware that each For the Record show yields a detailed, annotated, article-length description. Spitfire website is equipped with a search function. It also has the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile available for download. Be aware also that there is a page to click on for people who would like to support the work that I'm doing. What we're going to be doing, as I indicated, is updating a number of different broadcasts that I've done in the past, a number of different paths of inquiry. One of the first things we're going to be doing is taking a look once again at the subject of AIDS. In numerous broadcasts in the past, we've examined the strong probability, I believe it's a certainty, but let's just say we've examined the very strong probability that AIDS was deliberately created, that it constitutes a development project by elements of the Underground Reich who carried their work forward into the period when they were being sponsored by elements of the U.S. National Security Establishment. And there is evidence suggesting that work that was begun a long time ago had come to fruition, again, performed by the Underground Reich, apparently to a certain extent acting under U.S. auspices in the Cold War period. What we're going to look at in connection with AIDS, and again, there are numerous other broadcasts either available from Spitfire, such as RFA 16, or available on the web to talk about the possibility of AIDS as a biological warfare weapon. What we're going to look at, first of all, in this broadcast, is the fact that white people, specifically Caucasians from Northern Europe, have a gene that makes them immune to infection by HIV. They can carry the bug, but they don't get sick. And this has some very, very interesting implications indeed. We're going to begin by taking a look at some articles about a PBS special. This was called, this special program on the public broadcasting system, specifically public television, is called Secrets of the Dead. And one of the programs dealt with a gene that apparently made people resistant to bubonic plague and that apparently also makes them resistant to AIDS. And again, this gene does not appear in any race except for white people, and it is particularly prevalent in white people from Northern Europe, and the farther north you go, the more prevalent it becomes. This basically indicates that this gene for immunity against the HIV is an Aryan gene, unquote, which if the hypothesis presented on this program is correct, which is that AIDS was deliberately created, it would make it basically the Aryan disease. In other words, a disease to yield the promotion of the, quote, Aryan race, unquote. Now, dealing with the program Secrets of the Dead from PBS, from the PBS website, pbs.org, this is called Case File Mystery of the Black Death, and talking about the genesis of the Black Death or bubonic plague. After discussing its introduction in Europe, which apparently came from China, we read, skipping down, in September of 1665, George Vickers, V-I-C-C-A-R-S, a tailor in the small central England village of Iam, E-Y-A-M, received a parcel of cloth ridden with plague-infested fleas from London. 4 days later, Vickers died. By the end of the month, five more villagers had succumbed to the plague. The panicked town turned to their rector, William Montpeson, who persuaded them to quarantine the entire village to prevent the bacterium from spreading throughout the region. It seemed like suicide. A year later, the first outsiders ventured into Eam, expecting a ghost town, yet, miraculously, half the town had survived. How did so many villagers live through the most devastating disease known to man? Local Eam lore tells befuddling stories of plague survivors who had had close contact with the bacterium but never caught the disease. Elizabeth Hancock buried 6 children and her husband in a week, but never became ill. The village gravedigger handled hundreds of plague-infected corpses, but he survived as well. Could these people have somehow been immune to the Black Death? Dr. Stephen O'Brien of the National Institutes of Health in Washington, D.C., suggests they were. His work with HIV and the mutant form of the gene CCR5, called Delta 32, led him to Eam. In 1996, research showed that Delta 32 prevents HIV from entering human cells and infecting the body. This last sentence again. In 1996, research showed that Delta 32 prevents HIV from entering human cells and infecting the body. O'Brien thought this principle should be applied to the plague bacterium, which affects the body in a similar manner. To determine whether the Eam plague survivors may have carried Delta 32, O'Brien tested the DNA of their modern-day descendants. What he found out was startling. And again, this is Secrets of the Dead. I would note here that Dr. Stephen O'Brien works for the National Institutes of Health, and there is a disturbing body of evidence suggesting that elements within the National Cancer Institute, part of the National Institute of Health, were involved, along with emigre Nazi scientists, in the deliberate development of AIDS. Again, RFA 16 available from Spitfire, and a number of For the Record programs go into that allegation. More about the CCR5 gene, Delta 32, the mutation that apparently enables people to carry the HIV virus and not get infected with AIDS. And apparently, again, this immune gene only exists in white people and primarily white people from Northern Europe. More from the PBS.org website, again, from the program Secrets of the Dead. Case file, Mystery of the Black Death. And this particular page is called Clues and Evidence and reads as follows. For a disease-causing microorganism to infect the human body, there must be a gateway or portal through which it enters human cells. The plague bacterium works this way, hijacking the white blood cells sent to eliminate it. Traveling inside the white blood cells to the lymph nodes, the bacterium breaks out and attacks the focal point of the human immune system. Dr. Stephen O'Brien felt that the mutated CCR5 gene, Delta 32, may have prevented the plague from being able to enter the host's white blood cells. So again, this is the central element around which this path of inquiry winds. Basically, the CCR5 gene, Delta 32, which certainly, according to Dr. Stephen O'Brien's research, prevented the AIDS bacterium from infecting white blood cells and may have functioned in a similar fashion for HIV. Continuing. Eam, that's the English town that apparently had a number of people who had this immunity. Eam provided O'Brien an ideal opportunity to test this theory. Specifically, Eam was an isolated population known to have survived a plague epidemic. Everyone in the town would have been exposed to the bacterium, so it's likely that any life-saving genetic trait would have been possessed by each of these survivors. Like a Xerox machine, says O'Brien, their gene frequencies have been replicated for several generations without a lot of infusion from outside, unquote, thus providing a visible pool of survivor descendants who would have inherited such a trait. Knowing who died and who lived through the early years of the plague is somewhat problematic. Deaths among the general English population were not recorded in the 14th century, and most communities did not have enough recording parish registers until around 1538. Fortunately, Eam began keeping a parish register in 1530. Thus, historian John Clifford began by examining the register, noting everyone who was alive in 1665, the year the plague came to Eam. He searched for evidence of life throughout the year 1725, marriages, baptisms, burials that took place years after the plague had left the village. Deleting the names of those lost during the plague period, he was able to determine who the survivors were. DNA samples could only be collected from direct descendants of the plague survivors. DNA is the principal component of chromosomes, which carry the genes that transmit hereditary characteristics. We inherit DNA from our parents, thus I am resident Joan Plant, for example, may have inherited the Delta 32 mutation from one of her ancient relatives. Plant can trace her mother's lineage back 10 generations to the Blackwell siblings, Francis and Margaret, who both lived through the plague in the turn of the century. The next step was to harvest a DNA sample from Joan and the other descendants. DNA is found in the nuclei of cells. The amount is consistent and is constant in all typical cells, regardless of the size or function of that cell. One of the easiest methods of obtaining a DNA tissue sample is to take a cheek or buccal swab. After 3 weeks of testing at University College in London, Delta 32 had been found in 14% of the samples. This is a genetically significant percentage, yet what really did it mean? Could the villagers have inherited Delta 32 from elsewhere? Residents who had moved to the community in the 350 years since the plague? Was this really a higher percentage than anywhere else? To find out, O'Brien assembled an international team of scientists to test for the presence of Delta 32 around the world. Quote, "Native Africans did not have Delta 32 at all," O'Brien says, again quoting, "and when we looked at East Asians and Indians, they were also flat zero. In fact, the level of Delta 32 found in Iam was only matched in regions of Europe that had been affected by the plague and in America, which was, for the most part, settled by European plague survivors and their descendants." Meanwhile, recent work with another disease strikingly similar to the plague, AIDS, suggests O'Brien was on the right track. HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, tricks the immune system in a similar manner as the plague bacterium, targeting and taking over white blood cells. Virologist Dr. Bill Paxton of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center in New York City noticed, quote, "The center had no study of people who were exposed to HIV but who had remained negative," unquote. He began testing the blood of high-risk HIV-negative individuals like Stephen Crone, exposing their blood to 3,000 times the amount of HIV normally needed to infect a cell. Steve's blood never became infected. Quote, "We thought maybe he had infected the culture with bacteria or whatever," says Paxton, again quoting. "So we went back to Steve, but it was the same result. We went back again and again. Same result," unquote. Paxton began studying Crone's DNA and concluded there was some sort of blocking mechanism preventing the virus from binding to the cells. Further research showed that mechanism was Delta 32. Scientists studying HIV first learned about the gateway blocking capacity of the CCR5 mutation in 1996. Several drug companies then quickly began exploring the possibility of developing pharmaceuticals that would mimic Delta 32 by binding the CCR5 and blocking the attachment of HIV. So again, there is a genetic mutation that provides an immunity from or to HIV infection or from HIV infection. It is only present in white people and primarily in white people from Northern Europe who had been exposed to the plague. The implications of this are ruminated about in a web posting. Someone who reviews a lot of books on the internet and who posts under the name of Gemini Walker had a thoughtful reflection on the scientific information that I've just related. And by the way, the URLs for all of the material presented on this program will be available in the description for the record 472. And again, this person ruminated about the CCR5 Delta 32 mutation as follows. This posting is titled, "Aryan Genes Immune to Death from AIDS." This is the nightmare of AIDS no one wants to believe. As we come closer to celebrating on December 1st, yet another World AIDS Day, let's take a good hard look at what's really going on before we pour more of our ever-diminishing hard-earned money down yet another horrendous sinkhole. It's been found that some Caucasians who have tested positive for the HIV virus were found to take a long time to actually develop, quote, full-blown, unquote, AIDS, as they call it. It has since been discovered, since 1997, that 20% of European Caucasians have the so-called Aryan, unquote, genetic disposition. If both your parents, in other words, are of Aryan descent, it appears you can never die of AIDS, even though you might be infected. The reason for this is in the genetic coding of the killer T cells, which are part of the body's immune system protective shield. These are the cells that are attacked by the HIV retrovirus. The location of the attack has been discovered. It's on the CCR5 gene in the third DNA gene pair. The particular location is the Delta 32 receptor site. If either of your DNA pairs from either your mother or your father is Delta 32 positive, then the HIV virus can attach itself at that point. If you are Delta 32 negative, then HIV just floats around in your blood harmlessly for you. But even though you may be Delta 32 negative at both sites, you can supposedly still spread the virus. What's been discovered is that these 20% of European Caucasians are members of the Aryan gene pool. Also, it has been discovered that the farther north you go in Europe, say Norway, Finland, Sweden, etc., you find the highest percentage of people that are Delta 32 negative with the CCR5 gene allele. That this would be a simple coincidence is beyond all human reason. To say that HIV suddenly crawled out of the woodwork in Central Africa by someone being bitten by a green tree monkey is one thing. But then to say that the only human gene pool on Earth that is immune to HIV is the Aryan race is a coincidence that even Howdy Doody wouldn't buy. What we are looking at is a genocide perpetrated on racial groups of the world that makes the Nazi Holocaust look like romper room. Add to that the global trafficking in drugs that specifically targets minorities, the poor, and people of color, and while it may not look like the Holocaust during World War II, it doesn't have to. The AIDS epidemic isn't a mysterious virological disease, it is calculated murder, and a genocide that is beyond human comprehension. And since it is the venerated Aryan race that is immune to it, then one has to assume that they are the ones who promulgated it. Of course, one shouldn't assume anything, so we will continue to explore this terribly distressing theory as evidence presents itself. This disease has the ability to wipe all humanity off the earth. If it's true that everyone is at risk, that HIV is sexually transmitted, and that mothers and children are mostly at risk, half the population would be gone already in one generation. That clearly isn't happening. But something else is, and it goes on to talk about the PBS program. One of the points of information that I would bring forward concerns the fact that it appears that this disease, and there is a strong body of evidence suggesting that it was deliberately developed, basically is an underground Reich project. I suspect, and we're going to go into this in future programs, I suspect that some of the root research may actually have been discovered during World War II. Recall that there were very strong connections between the German Nazi Party and the Bruderbund, the elite fascist group that ruled the former South African apartheid government. Of course, the country of South Africa is one of the countries being devastated by AIDS. And in the past, we've taken a look also at the fact that the etiology of AIDS suggests that it's a genetically altered monkey virus. And I would note that in the concentration camp research during World War II, the etiology of AIDS was mimicked, or was reflected, I should say, in the pattern of experimentation, which began with apes and later jumped to human beings. One of the things that we're going to look at in a future broadcast, in addition to reviewing the employment of Dr. Eric Traub and Anna Burger, his assistant, Eric Traub being the chief of bacteriological and virological warfare for the Third Reich. He jumped to the U.S. National Security Establishment at the end of World War II, along with his assistant, Anna Burger, and the line of research that may very well have resulted in AIDS appears to have stemmed from those origins. We're also going to take a look at the fact that a guy who was a very high priority item for U.S. intelligence to get out of Spain, Franco Spain, in the aftermath of World War II, was a German scientist who had been requisitioning monkeys and apes from Africa for use for experimentation purposes by German laboratories. One wonders if perhaps he had been taking tissue samples and that's what made him such a high priority item. Certainly, the authorities in this country would have known how to get apes from Africa. They would not have needed to extradite a high-priority German alleged war criminal from Franco, Spain, and they were indeed pursuing just such an individual. These, however, are lines of inquiry we're going to be pursuing in a future broadcast. I would simply note, however, that the Underground Reich makes its plans well in advance. We're going to be in a future broadcast dealing with how the Underground Reich very cynically, very cleverly, too, used the Cold War and America's fear of communism and also the inclination to militant anti-communism on the part of our own power elite to conquer the United States. We've talked about this in some of our programs with Kevin Coogan, not conquering the United States, but basically extracting tremendous concessions from the United States by utilizing the threat of neutrality or even going communist, unquote, during the Cold War period. We're going to be reflecting on this in a future broadcast and using the book Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Tettens. That book was published in hardcover in 1953 by Henry Schumann and Company, but simply by way of taking a look at how far in advance the Underground Reich plans. There is a quote in this book. Again, the book was published in 1953. This is quoting Dr. Konrad Adenauer, writing in the Rheinischer Merkur on May 20th of 1950, about what Dr. Adenauer saw as Germany's future. And again, this is more than a half a century ago. And in this, he reflects not only on what basically we can now recognize as the German, as the European Union and the European Monetary Union, but also he talks about the need to colonize Africa. Adenauer said in May of 1950, "A federated Europe will become a third force in the world, not as strong as Russia or the United States, but powerful enough to intervene successfully and in a decisive way to ensure the peace. Germany has again become a factor with whom others will have to reckon in international affairs. There is also a long-range economic goal, the colonization of Africa. If we Europeans colonize Africa, we create at the same time a supplier of raw materials for Europe, which will be of the greatest importance." I would note that there is now loose in the African population a gene, or an infectious microorganism, which is wiping out Africa, changing the demographics of the continent of Africa, and white people, at least white people from Europe containing the CCR5 Delta 32 mutation, are immune. We'll discuss this at greater length in the future. Another program that we're going to be updating, another story, I should say, that we're updating in this program, and that concerns the Port Chicago explosion. Most recently, in For the Record 444, we visited with Peter Vogel, the author of the book The Last Wave from Port Chicago. That book is available online. It used to be available for free, but Peter is now has now rescinded the availability of that book for free. You can go to the portchicago.org website and check it out, but the book is now, in order to obtain the book, you have to pay for it now, so please be aware of that. I would recommend that people do that, and let me stress that I do not have any economic or financial connection with Peter Vogel. In a nutshell, what the Port Chicago explosion investigation is all about, it concerns the explosion of the E.A. Bryan, a World War II ammunition ship, at about 10:19 on July 17th of the year 1944. The explosion of this ammunition ship was supposedly simply the detonation of conventional munitions, but there's a body of information that has surfaced and grown more compelling, indicating that, in fact, this explosion appears to have been the explosion, a test in all probability, of the Mark II atomic weapon. That was an early and crude atomic weapon that was being developed in 1944, along with the Mark I, the Type 1 gun weapon, the U-235 gun weapon that was used on Hiroshima, as well as the Mark III. That was the plutonium bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. The Mark II is a device that has basically dropped from the historical record, but Peter Vogel's diligent research has uncovered the history of the Mark II and a very compelling body of evidence suggesting that the Port Chicago explosion was, in all probability, the test of the Mark II. We're going to be dealing with the Port Chicago explosion inside two of the program by way of introduction to that. This article appeared in the Salisbury Post. That's from Salisbury, North Carolina. And this concerns a Navy sailor, now deceased, an officer, in fact, Richard Rendleman, who apparently not only certainly viewed the Port Chicago explosion, but has ruminated about the possibility that it might have been an atomic explosion. He cannot provide, in his letters, cannot provide any definitive information about that, but by way of introduction to the subject of Port Chicago that we're going to be dealing with inside two of the program, did he see the first atomic explosion? "The morning after the blast, I went to see Inez. I held her tightly for a minute or so. I couldn't say anything, nor could she. Presently she asked, 'Is there any hope for Bob?' I answered by saying there was no trace of anybody. Then she wanted to know if he felt any pain or suffered any. I told her he never knew what hit him. Richard Rendleman, in a letter home, July 22, 1944. And this from an article about this by Rose Post in the Salisbury Post. Continuing. Did the late Richard Rendleman, Salisbury businessman, legendary golfer, and good friend to all who knew him, see the first atomic bomb blast during World War II? Not on Hiroshima, on U.S. soil at the Navy's Port Chicago on the California coast where he was stationed during World War II. Quote, "There's not only a reasonably credible hypothesis that it's possible," says his son, Dr. Nick Rendleman, finance professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, quote, "but there's also documentation that it could have happened," unquote. But Richard Rendleman wasn't at Port Chicago when the explosion shook the earth. He was off duty, 12 miles away from the naval base, about 14 miles northeast of San Francisco, his son says. And did he ever realize, Dick Rendleman wonders, that he might have provided some of the most detailed documentation of the most significant military accident on U.S. soil? Probably not. Dick Rendleman found the detailed documentation in letters his fathers wrote to his parents, the late Allie B. and John Luther Rendleman, and family in Salisbury. Those personal letters from a young man who just lost close friends and seen his naval base leveled by a mighty explosion during World War II, quote, "bring out a voice from the past," unquote, says Margaret Stiles, director of Port Chicago Naval Magazine National Memorial. And they have great historical value, she adds. They are directly his words. He wrote letters that night, the next day, and the next few weeks. He knew he was part of an historical event, and the letters are very detailed and express a lot of human emotion, unquote. And that's different, she says, quote, from interviewing someone 50 years later who is recalling the event. The letters are very fresh. It's connecting the past to the present, skipping down. Richard Rendleman was a lieutenant with the U.S. Navy on that July night in 1944. Ammunition was being loaded onto ships, and the equivalent of 5,000 tons exploded, killing 320 people and injuring many more. That was, and still is, the largest loss of life in any military accident on U.S. soil. The explosive force, Dick Rendleman says, was estimated to be the equivalent of a 5-kiloton atomic bomb, the equivalent of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, and maybe more than the equivalent. Peter Vogel, author of The Last Wave from Port Chicago, has worked on this, Rendleman says, for 20 years, and he believes it was actually the first atom bomb explosion. Quote, "The Hiroshima bomb did eventually go through Port Chicago. People from Los Alamos Labs were on the scene the morning after the explosion, and there were all sorts of other documents that led Vogel to believe it was the first atomic bomb." And we're going to deal with this in the second side of the program, as we're going to update the Port Chicago investigation. On the Spitfire website, in the For the Record section, there are detailed annotated descriptions of the various For the Record programs. 472 will be up within a week or so of the airing of the show. Please take advantage of those written records, as well as the audio archives being made available by WFMU. More recent For the Record shows streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available for download only at a longer URL. Link to both that address and the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, www.spitfireliz.com. Spitfire website has a page to click on for announcements about upcoming speaking engagements, a page to click on to find out how to support the work I'm doing. Also has Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile for download for free. Also has a search function, so please use the material on the web to establish your own database and disseminate as much of it as far and wide as possible. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 472, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates, being recorded on August 15th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.